what's for dinner?
Talking about what's ever on their minds. Talking about what's ever on their minds.
That's what we're doing, as we do every week here on What's For Dinner, talking about what's ever on their minds. Hello, everybody. Welcome to what I'm sure will be a very, classy is a word that comes to mind, but I, after knowing you for a couple of days, I don't know if that's even appropriate, but it'll definitely be an international show.
One question before we proceed.
Please.
Who the hell are you and what are you doing in my hotel room?
Surprise. Surprise. This is what I call ambush podcast.
Hey, right. I have been ambushed and podcasted.
Fantastic. Exactly. You've been pot-bushed.
Which sounds, that has so many meanings.
It does. And it sounds wonderful, actually. I am actually here working in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Don't want to brag.
Life in the bus lane.
It's funny. I'm working in Fort Wayne, Indiana at Snickers Comedy Club this week. It's actually been a very fun week. Great crowds.
Oh, we shall get onto that one later.
We will. But I actually had one of the great things about being a comic on the road is that you get to meet new people. You do. You get to meet new people through your travels. And I've been doing comedy for just about 20 years now, a little over. And I've met a lot of people on the road. So when I do the road, it's not often lately that I'm meeting somebody new, somebody that I've heard about or somebody that I know. This week I was very lucky to not only work with a funny comic, but a new comic that I've never met before. And we have quickly become chums talking about comedy and all the things that make it tick. And so my guest this week, very funny man, as you can tell from the accent. He's a newly planted from across the pond. Please welcome Keith Fields, everybody.
Hey, how you doing, everybody?
Hi, Keith. Thank you.
It's a pleasure being here.
Thanks for doing this, man.
In my hotel room.
Yeah,
where we are at the moment.
We took a little, my little podcast recorder thing and some microphones, and we're doing this in your hotel room. Literally, just sitting on your bed.
Most salubrious places. That's what it was.
Using those big words.
Oh, absolutely.
Most of us have.
I blame the education system.
Ours or yours?
Well, could be both.
I think so,
we'll
yes.
Come on to that as well.
But no, Keith is very, very funny. You describe yourself more as a performer, as an all-around entertainer, rather than just a comedian.
Yeah, I do stand-up routines within my set, but mm-hmm. I started out life actually as a street entertainer with a magic background, and in that venue I was working with all sorts of different skilled people, jugglers, sword swallowers, glass walkers,
wow.
Bed of nails, fire eaters, and we kind of taught each other. So I learned how to do some of those skills.
Wait, so can you sword swallow?
I can't sword swallow. That's something. I drew the line at that one.
I was going to say, you'd be very popular in some places.
Well, absolutely. But that is actually genuine. They do actually swallow swords. That is the real thing. And that's something I couldn't bring myself to do. But I've done the fire eating and the bed of nails and walking on broken glass and juggling and all those things. We used to do each other's acts. I might sound crazy, but when you're out on the street and there's a team of you sort of working a number of pitches, and you know when a pitch comes free, someone else jumps in, and you're all working with each other. There are times when you get bored.
Mm.
When I've done my show 3, 4 times, 5 times today, you just get bored. And we used to play tricks on each other. And there were times when I had a little box with all my magic-y stuff, and I used to do a straitjacket escape and various things like that. And I had a box with all my props in. And there'll be times when I'll be working the audience, and I turn around and I discover the other street entertainers have taken my box away and put someone else's box there, one of the other guys. So all of a sudden, I'm doing someone else's act. And it was kind of
like a completely different act?
Yeah, not like a different magic.
It might be
a juggler's props would be there.
Wow.
And you know, I can't juggle anywhere near as well as the juggler. But you basically, I could juggle 3, I could juggle 4 if I'm lucky. And it means that you're put on the spot and you improvise and you make things happen. I mean, I've done mime shows with no props when I had no idea what I was going to do.
Oh, God.
You just go out there and you pull a crowd and you just do it. And it's kind of crazy, but it's kind of fun.
But that's how
I got into this game. So that probably explains why I do what I do, which is whatever comes into my head, but a bit of everything.
Well, that's what makes makes your act very unique, I think, and very entertaining. But that, I mean, I love those moments where, and we've talked about this, just when you're on the spot, when you don't know what's going to happen. And it's, I can't imagine that, though, when you, when you're expecting to rely on a certain style or have a certain, you know, your bag with certain things, and then you get thrown something completely out of out of what you're expecting to do. Did you, I mean, did you have, like, amazing shows that came out of that, or was it a lot of shit?
Well, they were very much one-offs, I think, all those things. I remember doing a, what one guy used to do a routine with a head chopper.
Like a guillotine?
A guillotine, a magic Ruth, the guillotine thing. And I sort of, on the spur of the moment, improvised a whole sort of routine which was based on the political goings-on between the two parties at the time, and cutting off the head of the then Prime Minister. And it was all basically, I had no idea. I'm not really big into politics. I do follow politics and stuff, but I don't understand American politics.
Nobody does, not even the American politicians.
But so I was kind of into it, but I just went off in that direction and just kept going, and it was kind of a case of, it was a street show. If it all fell to pieces, if it all turned to custard, as we say in the UK, it wouldn't have mattered. It was a street show. The worst thing that would have happened is those people would have walked off and not given me any money at the end. That was the worst thing that could happen.
So it's very free.
Fantastic training ground for any performer.
Yeah, that really is like a very unrestrictive way to develop.
Yeah.
As opposed to like I did in the clubs where you had to get laughs. And
yeah, there's someone else telling you what you have to do and judging you all the time. And that's the great thing about street show. If you don't like the audience, you can just, you know, stop the show and go, actually, no, I don't like you, and then just start again.
How long did the show have to usually run?
There was no have to. There was no rules. The way it kind of works on the street, it's different in different places. Some places have licenses and set pitches and set times that you're working in set places. Other places are a total free-for-all, and you can work anywhere. It's just up to you, you know, not to get into any trouble. So a show could be anything from 10, 15 minutes if it's easy to get a crowd, up to 45 minutes to an hour. If the audience is there for that kind of a show, sort of depends on the weather. The place you're in, if it's a vacation area, resort area, people are more happy to hang around for longer. If you're working a busy side street where people are basically, they've got 10 minutes to spare, they haven't got all day, they're going back to work or shopping or whatever, then you only have to do short shows and get on, do the show, get the money and do another show. So there's all sorts of different processes. The same as in comedy, you know, everything's different.
Yeah.
Everything's different in the street as well.
It's one of those aspects of entertainment that you really, as I guess I should say, and my contemporaries, who are, again, only like stand-up and actors, whatever, we kind of don't really assume that there is such a similarity and as far as the way it's structured in that world of performing as opposed to stand-up or musicians or whatever. But there really is, a rule.
Yeah, oh, there is. There's different rules in different places. It's kind of bizarre because I often describe street entertaining as begging with a talent, because that's kind of what you're doing.
That
really
sounds actually very accurate.
All you're doing is saying, give me some money. Oh, by the way, here's a trick. Or, oh, look at me, I'm juggling four clubs or something like that. But then I actually sort of went on to my next development was actually, no, it's more of a sort of a happy, friendly con merchant. Because basically people are out doing whatever they're doing. They weren't expecting to give a total stranger money for watching them perform, but that's what you kind of do.
Yeah.
Everything a con artist does, you sort of suck people in, you get them to give you money, but you get them to enjoy the process.
Yeah.
So they walk off still smiling, even though they've given you some money they never intended to. So in a way, yeah, you could say they're conning people, or you could say people are tipping us, but I always like to think that we're more proactive. Tipping gives them the power.
The power, yeah.
You know, I like to say, no, we have the power. We're actually controlling these people. Because you'd be surprised how much there is a real level when you get into the higher level of street entertaining. There's a real level where you are manipulating the audience and guilting them into give you money. And it can be a very clever process.
If you do it right, yeah.
If you do it right, yeah. It's a lot of fun. And you'd be surprised how much money a street entertainer can earn. I mean, at the end of a good show, into my hat, sometimes 20, 30, 50, maybe even a whole dollar. It's amazing. Hey, see what I did there?
See what you did?
You weren't expecting that then,
were you? Just took a little left turn. And Keith Fields, everybody. And how old were you when you started street performing?
I was a latecomer, really. I was about 24, 25.
Oh, so most guys start younger?
Most guys, yeah. They start begging.
So why did it take you so long to get into it?
Just life situations. It was just, I had an opportunity to go that way and I thought I'd give it a go. My intention was to spend 6 months doing it because I had some friends that were doing it and it looked like fun, and then go back to work. But I never got around to going back to work, and that 6 months turned into 9 months and then a year and then 2 years, and then I discovered comedy clubs and and a career suddenly developed. So it was never, I never intended entertaining to be a long-term permanent career choice.
That's strange. Most guys go into it with that intention.
Yeah.
And you were, it went from just a lark to a life.
Yeah. My whole life has really been one joke after another, which sort of had consequences.
when you started doing it, did you already know a lot of magic, or did you kind of go into it
blind? Yeah, magic was a hobby, but I would never have in a million years dreamed I had the ability to, stand up in front of thousands of people and make them laugh. I didn't think I could ever achieve something like that.
Had you never been in front of a crowd before you started street performing?
I'd done kids shows, so I knew how to entertain kids, which is a lot of clowning and magic and that kind of stuff. But up to the point of going out onto the street, I really hadn't, even as a magician, I didn't like doing magic for adults. I just felt I hadn't found my legs, but I'd just suddenly thrown into it, really. It was just...
So you had no choice?
Yeah, kind of. It just happened, and at the time, it seemed like a fun thing to do, so I just did it and kept doing it. It really was kind of bizarre. I must have had some talent, because here I am 30 years later, still making a living in this game. So
in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh, yes. My career has been downhill for years now.
Apparently, I'm right down there with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say it's not so tough at the bottom, and it is crowded, so it's friendly as well.
It's a very good way of looking at it. So you went from street performing, and then you started doing the clubs.
Yep.
And that was, and you said you've been doing this for over 30 years now?
I've been a professional entertainer for 30-odd years, yeah.
So you started in the early 70s, or late 70s?
Late 70s, early 80s, okay. Yeah. 82, 83, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, yeah, so you're just over 30 years
Mathematics
now.
Is a wonderful thing. The education system we were talking about earlier.
As a Jew, I'm embarrassed. I'm usually much better with numbers.
Yeah. That's what drama school does for you.
Yep. So you started in the early 80s, and at that time were the comedy clubs starting to really develop in London?
They were really beginning to... sort of to develop. My first sort of foray into the comedy clubs was around about 84, my first experience freaked me out so much I didn't go back again for a whole year.
What was the first experience?
It was a comedy club called the Tunnel Club, which was a known rough house, but not known to me as a rough house. It was just, oh, that's a comedy club. Oh, they have performers go on stage. I'll go and give it a go. This was actually before I'd done the street, and it was just like total.
Oh, so you hadn't done...
I had no experience. Oh, total arrogance on my part. So I went up and did that. And it freaked me out. Absolutely freaked me out. I don't think I was absolutely awful, but I certainly don't think I was any good. I didn't understand what it was all about. I was naive. It was awful. And I then went out and did the street and worked the street for a couple of years. And was then sort of, people were saying, you should do comedy clubs. And I was going, well, I've done that once. I can't do it. Because of that experience 2 years before. But I didn't realize I'd had a whole lot of performance experience working the street between times. So then I went back in around about 84, and then my first open spot was in the Comedy Store in Leicester Square. So I sort of didn't start at the bottom when it comes to...
I was going
to
say, yeah.
I went straight to the very top, which is kind of bizarre. That was the biggest club in London at the time, 350-seater.
Mm-hmm.
That was a weird experience as well, because... as a street entertainer, you go on stage and the first thing you have to do is pull a crowd.
Right.
In a comedy club, you go on stage and the crowd are already there.
Yeah.
So I had a really solid 20-minute street show, but maybe 5 to 7 minutes of that was pulling a crowd.
Pulling people in, okay.
And I got on stage, hadn't thought it through, and suddenly realised, oh crap, the first 6 or 7 minutes of my show mean absolutely nothing. Because the audience were
already there.
So I had to, and I've seen street entertainers make the mistake of going on stage and still doing it anyway, and it's awful, absolutely awful, trying to pull a crowd who are already there. It's a totally different technique, and I just had to, I realized it and learned it on the fly and just flew with it, and luckily the way it worked in the UK, you did an open spot, which was usually 4 or 5 minutes was all you had. And if they liked you, they'd invite you back to do 10 minutes. And if they'd like you then you get back for a full set.
So essentially that first 5 to 7 minutes that you had to scrap didn't matter because you still had the 12, 13.
Yeah, but structurally it was suddenly very interesting because I didn't have an opening. Because in terms of, the comedy opening is a very, very important moment.
Yeah.
You know, that's the moment when I walked on stage realizing I had no idea how to start my show. I don't know what I did. I just remember I had that gaping hole in my head that I didn't know what to do. But I obviously did something.
I was going to say.
Because they immediately booked me and, you know, I was on the ladder. And
so you really you kind of landed with your running, like at one of the biggest clubs in the UK.
Yeah, somehow. Funny enough, there were two big clubs in the UK, the Comedy Store and Jongleurs. And about a month later, I went to Jongleurs. And my experience there was one of the other guys had seen me work the Comedy Store, and I was at Jongleurs, and they were an act short. And the manager of Jongleurs went to one of the other acts and said, "Have you seen this guy? Is he any good?" And she said, "Yeah." He said, "Yes, I've seen him at the Comedy Store." And the manager then comes up to me and says, "I'm an act short. Can you do a full set tonight?" I talked to the other acts. They say they've seen you. They say you're okay. And I said, "All right, as long as you promise to pay me." Money being kind of important. So I never did an open spot or an audition spot.
So
I just got booked straight into it.
The comedy gods were just smiling on me from the beginning.
Yeah, and goodness only knows why. But I've my whole career, some people work hard at their career. I've been very blessed and the doors have just opened in front of me. And I've just gone, let's go through them. And that's kind of how it feels to me, which might seem weird, because at the end of the day, 30 years on, here I am, a jobbing comic on the road. But I've made a living. I've had some high spots. I've had some low spots, and it's been a great journey, a great ride.
Well, I think that's the point. Is that some guys have it tougher than other guys? But like we were talking last night about the whole ladies and gentlemen, we got into the discussion about ancient aliens and things like that.
Yeah, we got into everything, didn't we, last night?
Nothing about comedy, just more about just conspiracy theories and whatnot. But one of the other things that Allison, my wife, and I are very kind of a believer in is energy.
Mm-hmm.
And things that are kind of laid out before us are there for reasons, you know? And I think some guys that have it tougher than other guys are the ones that need more experience or need more, for lack of a better term, lessons to be learned. And it seems like with the way your career has gone, because even though we joke about that we're here in Fort Wayne, you're a very successful comic. You do this not because you need to anymore. You do it because you still love it and still want
to. I you'll be surprised at this one. I even go out and do street shows occasionally.
Do you really?
Because I love it. This year I did a weekend in Chicago. Working outside the Wrigley Building in Chicago. I've got a friend who sort of regularly works there, and I went over to visit him and spent two days there. And there's a place called Frankenmuth in Michigan, and that's a kind of a bit of a touristy town, and I've been up there for two evenings. I just love it.
Let's go out now and
see. Hey, come on. let's do the show right here.
Right by that IHOP.
I want to live forever.
I want to learn how to fly. Hi! Side note, do you know that movie really well?
No.
Oh, you know? Okay, never mind. There's just a song from that movie that my wife and I, was one of the first things we bonded on was, holy shit, you know that song? And whatever. Sorry.
That's
this
right.
Show sometimes does that, segues into something totally weird. So you've had just opportunities.
It seems when I look back, amazing opportunities. I mean, just to sort of work on, cruise ships and flit around all over the world doing that and visit all sorts of fantastic places. I've done shows entertaining the British forces in all sorts of, in the jungles and in war zones and things like that.
And when you bring your bag through customs, do they have to go through it and, wait, what's this raccoon here?
Yeah, so you're bringing a raccoon and a knife and various other
a severed hand.
Yeah, all that sort of gags. Yeah, all sorts of strange stuff. It's a kind of weird. But
let me ask you this, because America, as far as in the comedy world, a lot of guys look at acts that are anything except the straight monologist, like any comic that goes up there with a guitar or goes up there with magic or goes up there with props or goes up there with puppets. A lot of comics who are purists, consider those to be, well, they're not comedians, they're, you know, they're cheating or whatever. In the UK, is it that kind of thing, or is everybody
No, we have the Comedy Thought Police as well, who in their own minds think they rule the roost and know what everyone else should be doing.
Really?
And anyone that is not a pure stand-up gets a certain amount of grief.
Did you have to go through that?
Yeah, and you know what? It hurt, actually. Oh, yeah. At times, it held me back career-wise. And actually, I look at it now thinking, actually, these were just bullies, and it's appalling, really, the fact that they were doing it as adults. And it's also appalling that I was sort of affected by it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it affected my confidence a great deal, even though I had, you know, opportunities in my career that many of them would have killed for. You know, you still feel you're being treated like a second-class citizen, which is kind of really weird. Because as a, we used to use the word speciality act. Do you use that term in America?
Sometimes,
Variety
yeah.
act, maybe.
Variety act.
Because I do chunks of stand-up, but I also do chunks of magic and chunks of juggling and chunks of clowning. And I do balloon modelling in a comedy club show, which most people go, how can you do that? But you can, if you're funny, you can do anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I always say I have to get as many laughs as any comedian, and I still have to make the tricks work, and I still have to make the props work.
Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot more going on in your head.
It's just a different structure. But when I'm on stage, I wouldn't say I'm your average comedy magician either. There is a certain mindset difference between someone who genuinely comes from comedy clubs and someone who is a magician who is doing some, you know, funny tricks or whatever. There is a different mindset, and I think the best way I could describe that is even though I'm doing a few tricks in my show, I'm not doing my tricks to try and elicit the audience to clap and go, oh, that was a clever trick.
Yeah,
they do. But that's not why I'm doing it.
Right.
I am purely doing the trick because it's a vehicle that I can use to get laughs out of the audience. That's my modus operandi, if you like. That's what's going on in my head.
So I see,
the
yeah.
tricks are the structure.
Are the catalyst to get the joke.
To get the jokes.
Yeah, to get the laughs.
Of whether I get to the end of the trick or not, whether it happens or not, to me is almost secondary. Now, the trick matters, and it's important because it is structurally important.
Right.
But for me, it's all about the comedy. Whereas your average comedy magician, it's kind of actually more about the trick, and they're getting two or three jokes in there or two or three laughs out of the trick. Therefore, they call themselves comedy magicians.
It's very interesting.
I don't like the term comedy magicians because I think magic is intrinsically funny. When you do something which people can't understand, one of the natural reactions is laughter. So because people laugh at you doing a trick doesn't make you a comedy magician. I'm sorry if you're a comedy magician listening to this and you disagree.
It's actually my fan base is all comedy magicians. So.
Yeah, so I, sorry. I for a while used the term comedian and magician. But I do think the term, what actually happened is people called themselves magicians, and that was all right for a long time. And then the sort of the better magicians, if you like, the ones that are making it, needed a way to differentiate themselves from all the other magicians, because there are a lot of magician hobbyists, it's kind of a different world.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great. They're part of the magic world, and they're a very valuable part of the magic world, and they contribute to it. But professionals needed a way to sort of separate themselves from that. So I think they started using the term comedy magician. And then everyone caught on, and other people started. Another professional came up with the idea of, oh, I've got to separate myself away from these comedy magicians because they've got a label which I don't want anymore. I'm going to call myself a comedian and magician. And then they've all started doing that now, and so it goes on. But there is a definite difference between
a magician and a
magician who has the comedy mindset.
So how about we start calling you a magician?
I like that.
Magician.
It's just next to impossible for you to say, and you invented the word. Magician. So how does anyone else stand a chance?
Or a commission.
A commission? No, I don't think a commission is going to work, is it? Magician. I kind of like that.
Magician.
He's a magician. What do you do? I'm a magician. No, I can't do that.
It's yours. You'd be the only one.
Yeah, I've called myself a one-man comedy variety show before, but I kind of think that's possibly a bit kitsch. I'm still trying to find a label that would work, but Yeah, or I'd just say Keith Fields is indescribable.
The indescribable Keith Fields.
Or just maybe just the indescribable.
Or maybe just...
The.
The. The. Just be a... What is that? A? I don't even know the grammatical term for what the is.
Is it a pronoun? No, it's not a pronoun.
That's not a pronoun?
No, that would be it or...
Them.
Them, not the.
The. Yeah. Anybody who's good with drama, grammar, and speaking. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing right now. Email. Let us know what the is. Wesh, I was just going to ask you something with the comedy midget.
I love the way, the professional way you just flow through this.
You know what? A lot of guys who do podcasts prepare with notes. Yeah. I'm very freeform. Yeah. And people have been listening to this show.
I think, darling, that's far more artistic when you do it that way.
I think so, too. Yeah, yeah. I think just like I said, I like being on the fly, not knowing what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. By the way, I like the position you're sitting in right now. Yeah, he literally has his legs spread open, and I'm trying to maintain eye contact.
Sorry, I don't apologize.
It's okay.
I'll move if it makes you feel uncomfortable.
No, actually, it was it was worrying me with how it was making me feel.
You need to get in touch with your gay side. That's what it is.
Well, you're British, and the accent just turns it up.
I know.
But you've actually talked about that too, about coming to America. Suddenly, you have an accent.
Yeah. Yeah, 50 years without an accent, moved to America, and suddenly got one.
You know what? It's something about that accent over here elevates you, elevates your act, elevates the way...
Thank you very much.
I'm being serious. It's about the way that American audiences perceive a performer.
This wasn't by design. I didn't move to America going, if I move to America, my British accent will be a real advantage to me. And I remember... being out driving with a friend of mine fairly soon after I'd been here, and he was sort of saying, you know, your accent is just gold out here. This is he was a teacher, a friend of ours. Paul Sanchez, in case you're ever listening to this was you. And it was kind of, I didn't believe him. Because this is the accent I've had and I've heard all my life.
Right.
And it literally took me probably 3 years. I've been here 4 years now. It probably took me 3 years to really work out that the way I sound is so different, it's so unexpected,
mm-hmm.
That people don't know what box to put me in. And when they don't know what box to put me in, I'm then on stage trying to break down all the walls of any box they might put me in. So I'm sort of I'm just getting more and more flamboyant as I go, really.
Well, so did you find it a hindrance at first when you came here?
I kind of found it a hindrance because... it's almost like people were going, you're British, therefore you are this. And I didn't want people to say you are this. I wanted to be free to be what I am. But I've just discovered the more flamboyant and over the top I am, the more the audiences seem to like it. So I used to be in the UK fairly more on the deadpan side as a performer.
Really?
Which I could see by the look on your face. Yeah. You're absolutely stunned. I wasn't a deadpan comic, but I was...
Well, give me an example of how you would do...
I can't even do it now. But I was... My whole delivery was quite often... when I was doing the magic stuff, I was doing the magic not as a ta-da, here's a big... you know, here's a trick, but I was doing the magic and going, yeah, right, fine, putting it down. And I was actually... the magic was all very much throwaway.
Okay.
Whereas now my arms are flapping all over the place, and it's kind of very flamboyant, and I refer to it as showbiz camp. I don't know if that expression means anything to you. Does
it? After seeing your act, it makes sense.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. So it's like total camp, and the more over the top I am. And here's the weird thing: I've learned that just by saying certain things in a British accent gets a laugh.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with the fact that I've said anything funny, but I'm experimenting with words and using them and saying them in different ways, and they just sound funny
to an American audience.
To an American audience. Yeah. And so just imagine if you didn't have to say anything. But you look like a Star Trek fan to me.
Thank you, but no.
No, really? Oh, no. Okay. Well, any Star Trek fans out there will be able to relate to. Did you watch any Star Trek Next Generation?
Not
Data?
Really, no.
Do you know who
Data? Oh,
Data.
I know who
Data is.
Yeah.
There was one of the episodes of Star Trek. Data was exploring comedy as an android.
Okay.
And he went to the holodeck. Do you know what the holodeck is? And he had the holodeck programmed as a comedy club.
Okay.
And he started performing to try and find out, to try, as an android, to try and understand comedy. This is a really in-depth explanation to describe.
There better
really
be a hell of a
point.
Payoff after this, Keith.
But this is what he was performing, and he suddenly realized that the audience were laughing because they were programmed to laugh, because they were a programmed audience, and anything he did got a laugh. And he was going, they're laughing because they're meant to, because they're a programmed audience. Now, my situation is I'm kind of experiencing the same thing. I'm saying things just as me, and people are laughing at me, even though I haven't done anything funny. And that's what Data was doing. He wasn't doing anything funny, but the audience were laughing anyway, and he realized that. And I've been through that moment of realization. And it's kind of beyond jokes, comedy beyond jokes. It's comedy based purely in the personality that you are, in the person. I'll tell you someone else who's really good at this is Billy Connolly. Do you know Billy Connolly,
yeah,
the Scottish comedian? When he tells a story, it's totally absorbing and hilarious, even though he's just telling that he hasn't got to the funny bit of the story yet. But he is so excited by the story, and his accent and the way of telling the story is so funny.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he hasn't done anything, that is
the comedy.
Funny in the traditional sense. And it's kind of people are laughing at everything you are rather than at the clever joke that you
write.
And it's a whole mind expansion thing when you get into that level of performance, which is kind of weird.
But I also think it's weird and it's wonderful. It's surprising, but it's not wrong either. Because I've always said that with comedy, there are no rules.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that says, you know, it has to be set up punchline. It could, like you said, Billy Connolly, Bill Cosby, great storytellers with laughs within the story, not a big setup to a big punchline.
Mm.
Or you look at, do you know Andy Kaufman?
Yes.
You know, Andy Kaufman was very anti-comedy. Mm. He was very, you know, trying to evoke other emotions from audiences, but still managed to be funny at the same time.
Mm.
You know, or the Kipper Kids.
Don't know them.
You don't know the Kipper Kids?
No.
I thought they were a UK act, like this kind of avant-garde comedy. Whatever.
Yeah.
My point is just that there is...
Your point is adequate without the Kipper Kids' help.
Exactly. Fuck the Kipper Kids is what I'm saying. No, I just think that the fact that you're finding these laughs that you didn't even know were there,
yeah,
it's like it really is like a really wonderful thing. But it's I don't know. I wouldn't think of it so much as surprising, I guess, because I've always believed that comedy can come from anywhere.
Yeah. It's kind of the thing is, if I mispronounce, this is the thing I find really funny. I one of the lines that sort of crept in, this is a routine that I haven't done this weekend. I'm talking about going to purchase something. And I say, if you go into the shop to make your purchase, and I say it like that, and it gets a huge laugh because I've mispronounced the word purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone thinks, oh, that's the English way of saying purchase. Isn't that cute? And they all find it hilariously funny. And I'm going, no, we don't really talk like that. it's just a very bizarre...
But you knew going into it that you were mispronouncing it on purpose.
Yeah, I'm just experimenting with the sounds. And it just seems that certain sounds...
So I wonder if I were to say purchase,
I have
it
no
probably
idea.
Wouldn't get the same kind of laugh.
Probably not, because they'd go, you can't talk properly.
Right. Oh, he's just special.
Yeah. Did you go to school in the big bus or the little bus?
The little bus.
Yeah.
And then I would purchase them down the street when they'd forget me. So you're just now really taking, like you said, you're... realizing that your accent could be a benefit, and it's something
hugely, yeah. And I've seen other British comics working over here, and they haven't really kind of played the accent card, or they don't seem to have done. They don't seem to have. Maybe they just haven't got it either, because it's taken me 3 or 4 years to really get the fact that there's something about the British perceived British personality, and I can create a real character
totally
out of this
totally.
I was talking the other day about my act, and I used the phrase, I think I might have to start jacking up. And I was actually referring to, I don't use anything like Union Jacks, the British flag or something like that, but to actually make how far should I take the British theme to make it? I mean, I wear the bowler hat and I sort of carry a, like a, it's more of a doctor's bag really, but I've got Union Jack umbrellas, which funny enough don't actually look like Union Jacks when they're folded up, only when they're open. But I'm just trying to find ways of making the whole British thing more of a thing
within the act.
Within the act, you know, because it is obviously, you know, as when you stand on stage as a comedian, the first thing you have to do is deal with the elephant in the room. If you haven't done that, if you've got, if you're, as a comedian, if you're particularly overweight, virtually the first joke you're going to probably do is a joke about anorexia or something like that.
Right.
That's kind of the rules. You know, if you're of any sort of minority, you're going to establish that because you're going to use that for comedy. It's the obvious thing about you. And being British is the obvious thing about me. As soon as I open my mouth, that's the first thing that anyone recognizes. So I need to really learn how to exploit that and get as much leverage off it as I personally
well,
can.
Well, you're, if I'm not mistaken, your opening line is something like, as you can tell, I'm not from around here, I'm from Detroit.
Yeah.
Which is a good, great line.
Actually, funny enough, that's not my opening line, but that's about four or five lines in, but it's the first line that anyone ever remembers.
Well, no, I mean, the one about the comedy club on the way.
And the reason why that's, I have to say all the other stuff before I say that, because they've got to be
used to the accent.
They've got to be used to the accent. Yeah. They've got to be thinking. A friend of mine who is an Australian comic in the UK once said to me about, we were talking about the whole accent thing, and I was going, oh, it's all right for you, you've got an accent. And he said, you know, the only thing an accent gives you, and in the UK, it doesn't give you as much as it gives you over here. But in the UK, he said the accent gave him a 60-second running head start.
Mm.
So because of the accent, the audience would actually allow him more, give him more grace, if you like. I think over here, it gives me quite a bit more than that. As it's easier to get the first couple of laughs because of the accent. And it's easier because I know what I'm doing to build on those laughs because of the accent.
Well, especially in the Midwest.
Yeah,
where there are not a lot of... Brits around here.
I haven't worked much in the sort of big cities in America, the New Yorks or the sort of where is it you're from? The other big city,
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. That's the place. I knew it had a name. So I haven't worked much in those places. So I don't know if I don't actually think it would make that much difference if you were working a really cosmopolitan audience.
Well, I know it. Our mutual friend Cole Parker, who's a comic who now lives in LA from the UK, been on the podcast before. I've found like watching him perform that there definitely is like a same kind of grace period because of the accent.
Yeah,
because people I think are fascinated.
Yeah,
you know, because especially in LA, there are a lot of Mexicans, a lot of Armenians, but not a lot of Brits.
Yeah,
not a lot of Australians. That accent has a very, I'm not comparing, I'm not saying they're both the same. I'm saying
if you study linguistics, you will very, and also something I've very quickly learned is the average American, if there is such a thing, finds it very difficult to tell a British accent from a Australian accent, from a New Zealand accent, from a South African accent. They're kind of grouped together in the mind. In the same way for me, I find it very hard to tell a Canadian from an American accent or an average Midwestern American accent and a Canadian accent. I find them very hard to tell the difference. I can spot a sort of a Bronx, New York...
Yes, if a guy came up to you and talked, hey, how you doing? I'm from over there.
Want a cup of coffee?
Want a cup of coffee? Yeah, we'll get some coffee. It'll be fun.
So I can spot that, and I can spot the Deep South sort of accent. But other than that, it's just American. And because I
hear... So somebody was in Fargo, North Dakota, and they talk like this, you might think they're from Canada?
Sorry, what accent was that?
That's supposed to be in North Dakota.
Yeah, all right, okay. I'll have to believe you on that one.
What about this one? Do you know this one?
Never been. No, I've never been to
North Dakota. Making that up.
Actually, I did make it a... one of the things I wanted to do was go to all the twin states in America. So I've been to... I haven't been to North Dakota. Yeah, North Dakota and South Dakota, the Dakotas. And then there's the Carolinas, North Carolina, South Carolina, and the Kansases. Kansas and Arkansas.
I was looking at that joke. Wait, what are you? Well, also there's Virginia. That's Virginia and West Virginia.
Yeah. No one's ever laughed at that joke, but I like it, so I keep slipping it in.
It's a good line. Now, are there a lot of other British UK comics in the States that you kind of hook up with?
I haven't hooked up with any. There's one or two. Jim Tavare is a very good friend of mine, guy in the double plays does an act with a double bass.
Oh yeah, Bald Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I see him out in LA a lot.
Yeah, he's lived in LA now.
Yeah.
We email each other every so often. He's been up to Michigan a couple of times, but I've never been around when he's been around. There are a couple others, but I haven't actually met up with any. I met up with a couple of Canadian friends when they've been sort of crossing this side of the border and, mm-hmm. and working over here. But no, it's America's a big country, and I live in Michigan, which is kind of, you know, not exactly the center of the world when it comes to comedy in America.
Not so much.
It's actually, you know, it's a wonderful place to live, and it's got a very bad rap, especially with
Detroit
stories. At the
well,
moment.
Yeah. But
yeah, I live 20 miles outside of Detroit, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Cheap as chips. I mean, it really is. You know, you get a fantastic house there for not a lot of money. The school system where I live is great. We love it. Absolutely love it there.
I'm going to see if my wife wants to move to Detroit.
You should do. It's a great
honey, place. We're going to leave California and go to Detroit.
Yeah, you do have to cope with a couple of things up there. Winter, maybe. Something might be new for you.
Maybe, a little bit.
Yeah. You go out to get the mail and go, what's this white stuff on the floor and why is it 18 inches deep? It wasn't there last night.
I actually do a joke where I talk about I went up to Toronto. It was the first time I ever saw snowfall. And I'm from Miami, so the only kind of snow I was used to was snow. Yeah. So I'm just running around going, holy shit, it falls from the sky.
Yeah.
wasn't the snow I was talking about.
Well, never mind.
So why is it then? Why exactly did you come to America? Why'd you leave? Because you had a very, very good career in the UK.
As a speciality act, I think I'd done pretty much everything I could,
so you just kind of peaked.
Yeah, and I think the comedy was definitely really happening, and it was very much the straight stand up that was happening. I'd had a few runs at some really good stuff. I almost had a TV series that was it was kind of written. We were just casting it and it was getting going. It was going to be going on out Sunday night at 10 o'clock, which is a prime sort of comedy slot, or it was a prime comedy slot in the UK back 6 or 7 years ago when we were working on this project. And it only didn't happen because the TV company I was working with was taken over by another TV company. If it had happened, you know what, you know, a sitcom, that's two zeros on the end of your salary.
Absolutely,
It's a big, big difference. So that was probably the pinnacle of my career in the UK, was something that almost didn't quite happen. I've been close to TV shows a couple other times, but never that close, never actually having the script written and everything. You know, they paid me to write the scripts and everything, so I've made a fair amount of money out of it already, but it just, in the takeover, it just got shuffled off the table, off the desk, into the trash can. Really frustrating.
I can imagine.
And I suppose that left me very disheartened with the business and everything else. And to cut a long story short, a couple of years later, my brother came over. My brother lives in Michigan, and he came over to the UK to play music at my son's wedding. When my son in England got married. And we started talking. And I only see my brother once every 4 or 5 years because he lives in America and I live in England, and, you know, it's kind of a long way. And we just started talking. And a couple of months later, he came back again to attend a funeral in the UK, and we just started talking some more. And I think that was the only time that we really spent as much time as that together in such a close period of time in many, many years. And he turned around and said, why don't you come to America? Because I was obviously saying I'm fed up with everything. And I said, well, you know, I'd love to, but I'm not Cuban and I can't swim. And we laughed. And then he said, no, seriously, why don't you come? And I go, well, you know, you have to get paperwork and everything. You can't just go to America. And he said, well, go and see a visa lawyer and see what happens. And I went to a visa lawyer, and my wife turned around and said, I'll never forget this, she said, why wouldn't America want us? My lovely wife, with her incredible confidence in everything. And I was going, no, don't be silly, there's paperwork. And I went online and checked it all out, and no, you see, there's no way we're going to get a visa, it's just a waste of time. But she insisted, and I have to say, unfortunately, she was right.
As they often are.
She rubs this in at every available opportunity. Because there's a, believe it or not, there is actually a visa that the American government give out. It's called a visa for aliens with extraordinary ability. That is the official name of the O-1 work visa. It's a visa for aliens with extraordinary ability. And it is...
I guess Superman would have that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It says on the paperwork it's for authors, actors, university professors, people that have sort of risen to the very top of their tree, basically can get it. And if you've got to the top 2%, then you can get a work visa. And if you're in the top sort of 0.5%, then you can get a green card and come and be a permanent resident in America, which is I had to prove that I had exceptional ability. Proving I was an alien wasn't so difficult. It all happened, and we moved over and, got green cards.
I mean, you didn't have to, audition or anything for...
No, that was kind of funny. I was how do you prove this to someone? Yeah. But there are, believe it or not, a set of proofs. And when the lawyer gave this to me and said, oh, yes, you might be able to apply for this visa because you're a performer, and she sort of went onto a computer and printed out a list of the evidence that we need to produce. And the first one was a list of any Emmys or Oscars or leading industry standard awards you've won or something. I'm going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Emmys, Oscars, I'm a comedian and magician. I don't really move in the world of Emmys and Oscars. And she went, well, have you won any awards at all? And I went, well, in 1988, I was International Street Entertainer of the Year. Does that help? And she went, well, is it a kind of an industry award? Well, it was kind of a big thing when it happened. Well, that's part of the evidence then, isn't it? Have you won anything else? Well, in 1997, I was Magic Circle Close-Up Entertainer of the Year. It goes, is that? Oh, yeah, write that one down. And, we collected all these little bits of information up, and they needed all sorts of other things like comments in the local press, in the national press. And luckily, I'd kept them all, and we went and sort of got all these things. And we put the whole stuff together. I went away and created a big scrapbook. So I've never been one for keeping this kind of stuff, but luckily I've kept enough. Big scrapbook of stuff, and I went, this is anything I can think of that may be of use to you. And I gave it back to her, and she said, fantastic, you've got enough here probably to get a green card if you're lucky.
Wow.
She said, I can never guarantee anything, but we'll go through the process. She wrote, well, the final document was about 2 inches high, which she produced.
Really thick.
And I read it, and I didn't recognize the person she was talking about as me. I was, really? Have I done this?
Did you bullshit your way into our country?
So, well, no. I just paid a lawyer to bullshit for me. But it was all evidenced and everything else. But it was just a great experience. And then the best bit of the experience was this whole process took 6 months. So it was 6 months from actually sitting in the UK going, let's go to America, to actually getting on an airplane and flying to America. And in that 6 months, that 6 months was spent renting out a house, working out what we're going to do about schools in America for the kids, packing. My wife had her own business in the UK, and we had to move that out of that because that was run from inside the house, and we had a couple of people come to work, and we had our garage converted into a
production plant, an
office and things. So we had to find premises for that and a manager to come in and run that. And there was a mountain load of stuff to get through in that 6 months. And we got through, and I bought me and my wife, and at the time a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, and we moved to America with 10 boxes, those sort of big boxes, like a 3 foot square.
Yeah.
3 foot cube boxes. And we just arrived in America and started again. It was absolutely the most stupid yet amazing,
thrilling, yeah.
Thrilling, wonderful thing.
You got to do that, man.
It was just, it really was just. I look back now, and if I'd have known everything that was going to happen, I think I would have been so scared I couldn't have done it. The ride, it's been a roller coaster, but it's been fantastic.
Imagine.
And now we're getting to a point when, the career's beginning to be established again. My act is probably maybe 60 to 70% of it is all new, and it's all stuff that I wasn't doing 5 years ago in the UK. So it's been a whole injection of energy and enthusiasm.
Well, you become a new performer, essentially.
Yeah, totally. It's the thought of going back, and I couldn't perform the show I'm doing now in the UK. It wouldn't work.
Really?
It wouldn't. No, I don't think it would. I don't think it would. It's much more Americanized. Brits do like it. I've worked on cruise ships where there have been Brits in the audience, and they... it does go, but I don't think it would go well enough in the UK to... I may be wrong. Yeah. I may be totally wrong. It'll be interesting.
So would you ever go back to the UK to perform?
I'm just talking at the moment about going back to do some magic conventions over in the UK, which will be more magic-y than comedy. that sounded weird for some reason. I don't know.
There you go. Yeah, Keith Fields, magic-y.
Yeah.
Magic-y.
Possibility, I don't know.
Magician, yeah, magic-y.
Yeah, we'll come up with it. We'll work on that one. Okay, folks, email us if you can work out.
What do you prefer, magic-y or magician?
Magic-y.
Magician.
Yeah.
Magician. I think that could be it. Magician.
Yeah. When I look at the market out here, though, it's such a huge market, and there's still so much left to conquer. So I'm just excited about what's.
So do you ever plan on going to the bigger cities to try to do some shows or anything?
I have lots of dreams and plans and things I want to do. How many of them are going to be real and how many of them are going to happen, I don't know. We've got my middle son who came with me over here has now gone away to college, and I've got another 2 more years before my daughter goes away to college. So that's going to sort of open up our lives in a new way, because at the moment we are attached to Michigan because of children at school.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of living there. When Felicity finally leaves school and goes to college in a couple of years' time, it's kind of we would still keep our base in Michigan, and I would imagine that when the vacations from school, we'll be back there. But I could see us maybe doing other stuff. We've talked about moving to New York and renting an apartment in New York for 6 months. And just for the sheer joy of experiencing a new city.
Yeah.
We both kind of love New York. Our home was in London, so we're used to living in big cities. London to 20 miles outside of Detroit is a bit of a...
Bit of a culture shock.
Kind of. So we're used to the big, bustling, metropolis-type, cosmopolitan cities. So we'd like to move to New York for 6 months and then do the same thing, maybe the next year go to San Francisco and just rent.
San Francisco's beautiful.
Rent a flat in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And live there for 6 months. And yeah, I'm sure I'd sort of try and sort out some work in advance and things like that, so some clubs and what have you. And it would be a work-based and an exploration, but primarily it's just wanting to experience more of America. And
that's fantastic. Yeah. I think that's what life is about, is experience. Because when you're in your deathbed, are you going to have the money or the awards or whatever? Are you going to just have the experience and the memories and everything that essentially made you you?
Yeah, well, exactly. Know? Yeah.
I think
it's, that was really brought it down, thinking about deathbeds. Thanks
for that. Well, I'll bring it up right now by introducing, I told you about this before, the little part of the show, mm-hmm. Keith. This is a treat for you because you've never even experienced the person in general.
No,
but for those who listen, it's part... What's that?
I've got no idea what you're talking about at the moment.
I don't either. It's time for the Skippy Green Show. Keith Fields, how are you?
I'm very good.
How nice to see you. Good. Skippy Green, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Good. Of course you're good.
Yeah.
You're here with me. Why shouldn't you be? All right, Keith, my friend.
Yeah.
It's good to see you again, by the way.
It's good to see you as well, sir.
Remember the last time we saw you, we were tag teaming that Iranian girl outside of a Pink Floyd concert.
It's sort of a bit of a cloud, that one.
Well, of course, there was a lot of clouds, a lot of things going on to create clouds. All right. Here we go, Keithy. Answer the following question in 10 words exactly. Not 11, not 9. 10 words exactly.
10 words exactly.
You ready?
Okay, yeah.
I'll count for you. Mm-hmm. If you... could fuck...
Is that the question, or is there any more to it?
There's more to it.
Oh, there's more to it. Just checking.
Using any prop that you use in your act, mm-hmm. what prop would you use and why?
Goodness me, I hope my mother never hears this.
She's a huge fan, I gotta be honest. Huge fan of the show.
I would use... a straight jacket because I like to... You see, you're never gonna know the end of that now, are you? You know, this is...
Oh! I thought you were good with numbers.
You shouldn't have limited me. I was just going to get on to the interesting bits.
That's why it's got to be a 10 words. You want to try it one more time?
Okay, how about a rubber dove? A rubber dove, that's 3 words. You're right, counting. Hey, folks, public school education. Would... work as a feathery prophylactic. Is that what you? That was 9 words.
One more.
Possibly.
Perfect. That was perfect.
It's the Skippy Green Show.
Is that one of the stupidest things you've ever done?
Skippy, come back.
Hello, hello. Keith, man, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, it's been absolutely hilarious.
It's been fun.
I've enjoyed myself.
And I mean this sincerely. It's been a pleasure working with you this week, too. It really has.
It has been a lot of fun. And we never got onto half of the in-depth comedy stuff that we've been talking about the last
know.
Few days.
I know. This show is a show. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, we could mention my website.
Well, but I was gonna mention that.
Just thinking we should get www.keithfields.com.
Keith Fields
tells you all about me, and you can find some video links.
And you have a DVD out, correct?
I have a the DVD that I have out is more of a teaching. It's designed to be teaching gags and ways of winning money out of people using magic. It's not really a performance DVD, though there is some performance on there as well.
Oh, so it's more of an instructional DVD.
Yeah, it's half instructional and half performance.
Ah.
So it's not your average.
What's one of the tricks that people can learn on the DVD?
Well, it includes a couple of magic tricks like cut and restored rope trick and things like that. It also includes half a dozen tricks which you can use. You know, the sort of things you do in a bar where you make her do a bar bet to try and, you know, win money out of people. Yeah, okay. A whole load of things like that on there as well. They're all things which I actually do when people say, show me a trick. I mean, I'd show you one, but on a
podcast.
On an audio tape podcast.
Well, show me one and I'll just go.
Actually mean very good. Okay. Hang on a second. I've got one here. I've got a microphone in your hand, and I've got. This is kind of weird.
Okay.
This isn't one off the DVD, but it's just kind of. I've got two little bands here, and I want you to put your finger out. I'm just going to hang that across your finger there, and I want you to actually make your finger and your thumb together. So now you can't see. You see, there's it's trapped on there.
Oh, sorry.
So you can see there's a pink one on your finger and an orange one in my hand.
Yes, right now it's like two rubber bands, and they're connected.
They're connected. Now I want you to close your eyes just for 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, and now open your eyes. And look back at them, you see, and they've actually swapped.
They've swapped places.
They have swapped places. Now, one more time, hold this finger sort of straight out so I can just put this one in there as well. And now close your fingers.
Okay.
Okay, now you've got two bands around your fingers there, an orange one and a pink one. Just pick any color.
Tell you what it is? Or
yeah, name a color.
Orange.
Orange, okay, so I'll take the orange one right off and give that to you. Pink one's still on your finger.
That was a really great trick.
It's kind of cute, isn't it?
It is very cute.
It's absolutely nothing to people who are listening on a podcast.
Well, to those listening, it really was it's a very cool little bar trick.
Yeah,
I could see how. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, folks, if you could tell by my tone, it was a damn good trick.
Stunned
so
silence.
Go to keithfields.com and order the DVD. It's a good deal.
It's a good deal.
Good. It's a good deal.
It's a good meal. It's a big dole.
It's a
it's a big bool.
It's I'm trying to think of the fucking word. It's it's magedy.
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 It's pure magedy, folks.
Magedy beyond your imagination. And you said you were on Twitter?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, Facebook.
What's your Twitter at?
The Keith Fields.
At The Keith Fields. There you go. So follow Keith Fields, and you have tour dates and everything on your site?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Usual stuff, yeah.
And guys, you know my shtick, flipisfunny.com, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, my CDs, that movie that I did, it's still out there. I'm starting to get residuals soon, so help me get more so my wife and I can move out of an apartment and to Detroit. So thank you guys for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.
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 What's for dinner? What's for dinner? What's for dinner? Talking about what's ever on their minds.
Music's fading.
Did you write this yourself?
I did.
You're a very talented man.
Thank you.